45 metres back. Bernard Foley's
got the legs.
It's got the legs. The distance.
Hello and welcome to Pick and Drive Rugby. We are the People's Podcast, providing a platform for rugby lovers to come together and support the game that's played in heaven. I'm your host, Mitch. Joined with me this week is co-host Lockie. Lockie, how are you, mate? It's been a little while since we've been able to get together for a podcast. What's been going on? What have you been doing?
It has been a little while. Hey, Mitch. Hey, everyone. Good to see your face. Busy times after the Aussie under-20s campaign, which we'll touch on in a tick. Been able to catch up on a little bit of work, been building some furniture, all the fun things that you do on your weekend. How about you, mate?
Yeah, had the week off last week and went away down to the South Coast just to get away from Sydney for a bit and a little bit away from rugby, and came home on Friday afternoon to some mixed results from Super Rugby over the weekend. And there's things sort of wound on through the weekend, Wallaroos and then Waratahs last night. So just not really a great weekend of rugby, unfortunately, but it has been a week since we've had a podcast. So dusting off the mic again and making sure we're getting here and trying to speak as positively as we can around some of the results, but it's going to be a pretty tough podcast, I think.
Oh, tough if you're a Tars fan and a Reds fan, but luckily we've got the Force and the Brumbies flying the flag this week. We've got to chew through a bit of Pack Four as well. There's been some interesting results. We haven't been able to cover any of that campaign because we've been away really throughout the course of the Canada and US games. So we'll blow the top off that and keen to jump in, Mitch.
Yeah, so let's run through the results from a tipping comp. It has been a little while since we've given an update. So Wilson's Warriors on Nick W is still in first place, up the top on 58 points. So well done to Nick. I think we were talking a little bit a few weeks ago off air around his results, and he's in the top 20 or something of the world tipping for Super Rugby Pacific. So well done to Nick. Great to have him in the Pick and Drive Rugby community, and well and truly up the top there, and has been for a few weeks.
Yeah, massive. Send us your tips next time, mate. We need to get him in the chat, get him on the pods, send us a few little inside lines because he's been doing well. We've also got big boys, Pearson C in there in second. We've got Mystique, Leanne T, I'm in third, and then the Corey Hotline, Steve L, familiar name there, bringing it in, 55 points on fourth, getting congested up the top there, and I see your climb up the ladder slowly but surely continues.
Yeah, I was 142nd, I think, last time we recorded a podcast. I'm currently 138th. You did say before we hit record that I finally got low enough to beat you on the record, and you haven't put your tips in for a few weeks. So let's see if I can keep going.
I'm there on 142. We've traded places. It's not my best season. I got to be honest. I need to jump on that quicker. But we're going to press on into the footy, mate. What have we got today?
Fantastic. Well, let's leave it there for the intro and dive into the rugby content. So let's start up with a little bit of an update on the under-20s rugby championship that finished up a few weeks ago. Now, Lockie, you were in camp with the under-20s covering that. Awesome. For anyone who was at home or didn't catch these games, if you do get on the stand coverage, you can actually get a few glimpses of Lockie at the end of the game, walking around with a camera, getting the boys together for a photo. So it's good to put a face to the name and see Lockie doing some of his stuff in his natural habitat if you haven't been able to do that. But the final game of the championship was Australia versus the All Blacks. The final score was 25-36. Now, as tight as this competition was, that result meant that New Zealand won the inaugural rugby championship, or the under-20s, and got the massive trophy, as you were saying before it kicked off. I actually saw them for the first time when they handed the trophy. It's like a meter and a half long. It's bloody huge. But what is interesting about this tournament is 15 minutes or so, Australia in that game towards the end have every opportunity to win it. If they win that game, they win the overall championship. They lost that game, unfortunately, and it meant that they lost the overall championship. They finished fourth on 4 points, an absolute incredibly tight competition, which was just right up to the final minutes of the competition, who was going to win. What an exciting way to kick off a new tournament and a new sort of platform for our development pathways.
Oh, it was absolutely terrific. It was such a great atmosphere there as well. The crowd up in Sunshine Coast, I'm not sure if every single South African migrant in Australia was there, but it felt like it because the crowd was very pro-Boca for most of the week that we were up there. But it was, you know, the result between this Baby Box and the Pumitas, the Springboks getting a late win 30-28, it set up a grand final of sorts between Australia and New Zealand. And you're right, with 15 minutes to go, our Aussie boys were in the box seat. A couple of great young talents flexing their muscles. We scored three tries in pretty quick succession in the second half. A young West Australian flanker, Dane Sawyer, went over. Will McCulloch, a winger out of Brisbane, scored a double really quickly. And you could see that belief growing. And also, they had a man up. The Kiwis had a man in the bin for the last 10, but the New Zealanders just went up another level and the Aussies weren't able to keep up. So you credit to the Kiwis. They managed to pull it away 36-25. Tough in the dressing room after that. A lot of disappointed faces, but they've got a World Cup coming up and that's the bigger picture. So Australia's been cast in a pool with Ireland, Italy and Georgia, and there'll be high hopes that they can top their pool or get close to and head in towards lifting the trophy that really matters at the end of this year.
Now, on a personal element of this tournament, you must have been absolutely ecstatic just to be involved with some of the rugby caliber and knowledge that was on show in this tournament. You sent us off air on our Pick and Drive group chat a photo of yourself watching the Waratahs and Brumbies game next to Laurie Fisher. Now, that has to be a wet dream, a rugby wet dream come to fruition. Getting to watch a game of rugby next to, or even of that caliber, with how tight that contest ended up being, with the Lord himself, like incredible.
It was an interesting dynamic in there because you had Nathan Gray on one couch going for the Tars and Laurie Fisher going for the Brumbies on another one. So I'm not sure who I would have rather backed in the end, but the rugby IP in that 20s camp is amazing. You know, Nathan Gray's been around for a long time as a player and a coach. Laurie Fisher, you know, the godfather of, you know, breakdown and forward play in Australia, and then some incredible coaching caliber coming up as well through the TARS system. You know, physios who have worked across, you know, every international team up to the Barbarians and beyond. There's incredible talent behind the scenes in Australian rugby, which was really great to be a part of and to get us a glimpse inside. But I'm pretty excited for what this group of players can do in South Africa. I think finishing fourth is a bit of a rough trot, given how close that ladder was. But I've got pretty high expectations and hopes for this under-20s group in South Africa. Last year, they won over there, finished fifth. They beat Wales, they beat New Zealand, and they just couldn't quite get out of their tough pool to qualify for the semis. So this year there's a real opportunity I see for them against the Italys and the Georgias, who are strong emerging nations, but maybe don't have the same caliber of talent out wide. Ireland will be a real challenge for them. Ireland were very strong in the under-26 nations, but I've every faith that a stacked under-20 side with the likes of the Harry McLaughlin Phillips, the Jack Barretts, potentially a Max Jorgensen who could come into the fold. That's always an option that can be floated around. We've got to remember he's still so young and would qualify, and I would love to see him get that opportunity in the 20s. So, you know, with those X-Factor players on board, I'd have every hope that they can, you know, qualify top of their pool and, you know, push for a semi-final and final berth.
And moving forward, kind of what was the key message or the takeaway from the coaching staff of how the team performed in this tournament, and what are they looking to improve on moving into that championship later in the year? And I imagine probably not with the Wallabies schedule that happens later in the season, but Lord Laurie probably won't feature with them and continue coaching in South Africa with them, will he?
No, so Laurie's done with the 20s now. He'll join Joe Schmidt in the Wallabies camp. Well, if not, he hasn't already, I'd say. But they'll have two more forwards coaches coming in. I'm not sure if it's been publicly confirmed, so I won't spill the beans there, but some pretty high-quality, high-caliber former players coming into the fold in the forwards role, which is really cool. And I think the messaging around the end of that tournament and heading into the World Championship is, you know, be proud of the effort and the grit, because there was plenty of that in three tough games in pretty crappy conditions in the rain up in Sunny Coast, but also be disappointed because I think they do have a higher ceiling than what we saw there. and, you know, patches like the three-try blitz against the All Blacks in that last game, patches of play that they produced in the second half against the Springboks were immaculate. And, you know, even in the rain and the grit in Argentina, they still showed that, particularly through the middle, their wide running forwards and their centres are able to break through the line and get an arm free. So it is an exciting team. And I think that the disappointment of the TRC campaign and falling so short, you know, in the last 15 minutes of a tournament, yeah, will be able to fuel a really positive bounce back over in South Africa. So that starts at the end of June. I'm pretty sure, okay, the World Championships, and it'll be streamed live on Stan. So I'd encourage everyone to maybe don't wake up too early if that's not your thing, but I'd be catching some full replays and some minis over the next month or two and following our Aussie under-20s.
And not too long to wait either, which is great. So can hopefully carry some of the form from this tournament into that next one and go really well over there in South Africa. So let's keep moving along. There's so much rugby to talk about. The Wallaroos is a talking point that we haven't been able to focus on. Since our last podcast, we previewed their first game of the year, which was against Canada. Canada, which unfortunately they did go down 33-14 in that game. On Friday this week, they then played their second game of the Pac-4 series against the USA. Final score in that one was 32-25 to the USA. A lot to unpack in that game. Before we dive into the second one, let's just quickly get a few thoughts or talking points from that first game against Canada. Lockie, how did you think that the team played in that first test of the year under Joe Yap?
Yeah, it was an interesting one, Mitch. I came out of it with a lot more questions around our forward pack than answers. We know that we've got great strike power out wide with that largely TARS base, which makes perfect sense given how successful they were in Super Rugby Women's. But I thought the pack got bullied against the Canadians. They showed us up physically. They showed us up at set piece, and particularly their rolling maul was a huge weapon that they used to great effect. So I think that was a good learning curve for a lot of our newer players, our younger players, particularly up front. You know, seeing Sally Fusana and Heribar Malcolm Heke get a debut was great. But I think probably the engine room of the Canadians showed us up, and that would have been a point of pride for, you know, seasoned players like the Mac Leonards, the Caitlin Leanies in the middle, who offer a lot of that grunt. So that's what I took out of it. I took out that we were a bit bullied. But, you know, there were still green shoots out of there, you know, being able to see players like Lane Morgan grow into confidence as a starting nine, at least for that week, I thought was really positive. And, you know, seeing players like Pessi Palo and Piper Duck lean into the enforcer role has been really exciting for me. Did you have any main key points out of the Canadian game outside of the forwards?
I think what was interesting for the key takeaway for mine out of that Canadian game was that we didn't use or utilize our back three enough. I didn't think that we got the ball into the hands of Maya Stewart or Desiree Miller in space enough in that game. I think there was one passage of play where Miller got the ball, I think, very close to halftime, and I think it was, and she ended up knocking it on. It was a poor pass or a kick through, but it was the first time that she touched the ball in the half. And as we had seen from the Waratahs all season, when you put those girls in space, Miller or Stewart, they're great finishers and they're lethal. But we just weren't able to get the ball out that far, and that's a credit to Canada. They really shut us down in rush defense and didn't allow us to spread it that way. Moving into the test on Friday against the USA, both Stewart and Miller were much more involved in that, in the attacking raids and the scoring points. Like in the first half particularly, they both looked really good with ball in hand, and the Wallaroos were able to get so much more go forward out wide because they got those girls in space. And it was interesting decision as well from Joe Yap moving from the Canada game into the USA game to rest a few players. We saw Caitlin Hulse, is that her first name? Get her first debut for the Wallaroos at 16. Incredible, the youngest Wallaroo ever to play for Australia, which is incredible. Laurie Kramer then moves from fullback starting against USA to the bench. Hulse comes into the starting side. And yeah, I don't know if it was the best performance of the year we've seen from her, which is to be expected at this level. But green shoots there for her, and excited to see more of her throughout the campaign and throughout the year. But that Wallaroos team, I don't know, maybe we'll talk about a little bit more about that the second half in just a moment, because there's so much to unpack there. But I guess the transition from the team that played against Canada to the team that played against the USA, what were your sort of thoughts around the changes that Joe Yap made to that 23?
I thought the biggest change came in the form of Sammy Woods coming in at, for Lane Morgan. I saw, and I noted that Lane, I thought, had quite a strong running game in the first outing against Canada, and Sammy Woods doesn't offer the same speed around the ruck that Lane does, but she offers great service, and that's something that they pointed out through the week, was Sammy Woods' delivery and her speed from the ruck to deliver to first receiver was higher. I thought she played really well in a starting debut and offers a lot of calm, but I'm not convinced that she is yet at the level to succeed Lane Morgan as a starting nine. Whether it's, you know, bringing Lane Morgan as the injection of energy later on, I can see that as a role where one's a starter and a finisher rather than a primary and a secondary. But I think against the States, who grew in confidence as the game went on and really started to put pressure, I think you needed to pick and stick for that one. So I'm interested to see what decisions are made against the Black Ferns. But I like what I saw from Sammy Wood with her delivery. Again, the physicality from the Australian loose forwards was really good. But to go out to a 20-8 lead at halftime and then have it spill, I mean, that's a massive blow. We have to be pretty frank here, Mitch. That's a massive blow to the Wallabers' hopes of qualifying for WXV1. And there's going to be a lot of soul searching after dropping a lead like that at home.
It's almost, as an Australian rugby fan, it's not great to see a team come away with a result like that. As you said, 20-8 at halftime, very much in control in that first half. And credit to USA, they put us under a lot of pressure in the second half. The way that they noticed, similar to what Canada was doing in the first game of the year last week, was that there was space in tight. And if they went through our forward pack, they were starting to make meters. And that's what they did in the second half, and we didn't have an answer for it. So they adapted the way they were playing in the first half. They allowed us too many opportunities to get the ball out wide and to get our back three involved, to get one-on-one situations and to get line breaks. But to their credit, USA completely shifted things around, put the momentum back in their favor in that second half, and just continually ground out the win. Frustrating from an Australian perspective that it's like, on reflection, it almost felt like, I don't want to go too hard on this, but sometimes when you look at the decisions that were made in terms of selection, that maybe we didn't credit USA enough with the players that we chose from the 23 and the changes that we made from Canada into that, and didn't give the full team enough time to gel moving through the competition. But again, that's reflective looking at the result and saying some of the changes that were made prior to that. I think the fact that we allowed USA to get the ascendancy in the second half and never got back in front and never were able to claw that momentum back in our favor is something that we need to work on moving forward.
I agree. And we mentioned it briefly at the start of this game, but the USA, and I think US sport in general, is so confidence-based. Like, when they're up, they are up. And when they're down, they'll collapse. So yep, the fact that they were able to bounce back from a 12-point deficit at halftime, you know, score two quick tries through Hope Rogers, who had an absolute blinder at a loose head prop. She was just a star in touch. She was playing like, you know, Eva Kapani at the back end of that WXV, just unstoppable from close range. And that groundswell got them through. It was, you could hear the players like Charlie Jacob, but you could hear it all day through the ref mic, just screaming, encouraging the Kate Zachary on the side. The USA skipper was so vocal, and their whole team, they out communicated us. They were louder, they were faster off the line, and I feel like that really informed their second half fight back. So credit to them. But it's clear that the Wallaroos, and not having got the States, but the Wallaroos had more talent, and, you know, in those rare moments where it finally clicked, you know, you saw Piper Duck go through first phase line out, feed G Fred, like it was the easiest try they'd scored, you know, all year. That was a training paddock try, just like that first one to Desi Miller in the top corner. And it's about, you know, it's the in those intermediate 20 minutes where nothing happened for them. You know, the chat went off, things didn't click, and it's now a huge task for them to go over to New Zealand and try and keep their WXV1 hopes alive. I'm not sure what Canada's recent win over New Zealand means for their qualification hopes. I think it's, you know, it's a tough ask to, you know, beat New Zealand on the best of days, let alone after a loss and you're playing them in New Zealand. But there's a lot hinging on the next few weeks, and we're going to learn a lot about this Wallaroos group I think this year there was amazing lift in support, in exposure off the back of the success of WXV. So what happens when we see adversity? What's the other side of the wallet, as it will see? And that's what I'm really interested in finding out throughout the year. So a big, big 2024 coming up for our women.
Yeah, what I think is quite interesting leading into this game, obviously what's happened this afternoon is the Black Ferns lost for the first time ever to Canada. Canada have won Pac-4 for the first time. They've beat New Zealand, the Black Ferns, for the first time. Incredible result for them. Leading into that game, or before that game this afternoon, the schematics or what the Wallaroos needed to do was to go to New Zealand, beat the Black Ferns by a bonus point to try and get into WXV1. Now, whether the result this afternoon from the Canadian game does change the need for a bonus point, potentially, we're not quite sure yet, so we'll have to figure that out. But the difficult thing is that, well, the Wallaroos still need to beat New Zealand for the first time ever. They have never been able to do that in the history of the Wallaroos, beat New Zealand. So that's a massive task. But the positive for the Wallaroos is they have time together now. So when you reflect on their setup and the lead up to their first two tests of the year, they've got a completely new coaching staff. They've got a completely new coach under Joe Yap who's come in, and they've had a week, maybe 10 days together to gel as a unit. There's been some selection changes. She hasn't gone completely rogue and done an Eddie Jones and not selected certain players, but there are players not available through injury. There are players that are getting shots for their first time, and it will take time for a team, particularly a team of like the Wallaroos, where they're semi-professionals. So they're already playing or adapting to the professional environment in Super W, and every year it's getting more and more professional, and there's more and more sort of money and resources put in to those programs. But it's going to take time for these girls to adapt to this new style of play, and I think that's what we're seeing, that these first two games, and to their credit, both Canada and the USA have been very, very competitive, and as we've seen today, Canada have got on to beat New Zealand. So you got to take that result into account when you consider that as well. But I just think as the season wears on, as the year wears on, as the Wallaroos get to play more tests together, they'll get tighter as a unit, they'll get to really understand the gameplay and the style that Joe Yap is bringing. And hopefully by the end of the year, we'll see much more improved performances than we've seen in the first 2 weeks.
And I think we will, because maybe the reason you and I are looking upon this, not harshly, but with some criticism, is because we know that the players and the quality is there. We saw it last year. We saw the talent that they have, and the performances that we've put out in our first two games aren't reflective of that. So I'm excited to see them go over. And that's what I was talking about before when I said, you know, we'll see this new side of the Wallaroos where they're up against it, where they've got the adversity. It's not this, you know, crazy rush of adoration that they beat France and Wales last year. This is back against the wall. What are you made of stuff? And I'm really excited to see that. There was, you know, devastation in the camp. You could see it on the faces of the players full time after the USA game, the Wallaroos' faces. They were gutted. You know, Michaela Leonard's press conference. You know, that's some steely eyes.
That was Michael Wells' levels of disappointment just staring at the camera there.
Yeah, it was nuts. So I'm really interested to see how they go. The ladder as it stands, I found a Pac-4 ladder, so I'll quickly go through it. Canada's already won. They're on 14 points. New Zealand are second. They're on 6 points at the moment with two bonus points. The USA will only finish third with five because they're all done, and we're on 2 points. Crucial that we got a bonus point against the USA there. So what's going to happen now is we need to go over there and beat the Black Ferns. So if you're ignoring bonus points, even if we beat them, we'll finish up on 6 competition points, deny them a bonus point, and we'll win on head-to-head versus New Zealand, right? So that'll bump us ahead. So with highest we can finish is second. Huge ask, though. Like, that's one hell of a challenge. But Canada's proven that it can be done.
Yep.
And we didn't play particularly well against Canada. And so now it's all on the line. You know, a mate, can you imagine, though? Like, a mate in Laurie O'Reilly Cup, we go over to New Zealand, we knock them over, their economy collapses. You know, there's scripts waiting to be written here, Mitch. So get behind our girls as they head over to Auckland. I think they're playing at North Harbour Stadium. That should be a cracking day out and go the Wallaroos.
Yeah, really, really looking forward to seeing what this team can do later in the season. And just sort of reflecting on what their performance that they've put in last year or the year before at the World Cup, some incredible performances against France and Wales and as far as they went into that tournament and even the results last year, you have to take into account when you look back on that, that was towards the end of their season. So they had time together as a unit. And this is their first 2 weeks. As I said before, I'm sort of harping on a little bit of the same thing. But they'll just get better the more time that they get together. And that means that we now, look, the other thing that we haven't mentioned yet, which is disappointing. Yes, they're not, well, they're not quite not in WXV1 yet. They still have a mathematical chance of getting in there. But what it meant, if they had beaten the USA, they would have got automatic qualification into the next year's World Cup. And so what that now means is they have to go through a repechage process to get qualification into that. There's two sides of that, I think. The first side, you look at that and go, well, that's disappointing. We would have loved to have just qualified now, focus on the rest of the year and get our preparation ready. But the other side of that is that we go through this repechage process. It's more games for us to play. So it's prep leading into that World Cup. It's probably not ideal being one of the, as an Australian, you want to say we're maybe the top five rugby playing nations in the world, wherever we, the Wallaroos or the Wallabies sit on the world rankings, regardless of that, that we're not automatically qualifying for World Cups. But the highlight is of that, or the positive is that we have more games for these girls to play together to get better as they move into the World Cup next year, which could ultimately pay off when we get to that tournament.
Yeah, and look, the permutations will be clear once we see the result from our game against the Black Ferns. Yeah, fingers and toes, but regardless, plenty of footy to come before the World Cup, and that's still plenty of eyes on, you know, winning that tournament over in England in 2025. But I think it's time for a bit of Super Rugby Pacific, Mitch.
It is. So let's get into round 13 of Super Rugby Pacific. We did miss round 12 last week. From memory, there wasn't too many highlights, so nothing to focus on really from that. So let's get into round 13. And things started up on Friday night between the Hurricanes and Moana Pacifica. 32-24 was the final score to the Hurricanes. A pretty expected result in a lot of regards. I think Moana surprised a lot of people in that they were still in it and pushed the Hurricanes right till the end of that game. But the Hurricanes have been such a classy side. They've done everything this year to win games and be competitive in them. You just expected them to get the win there. So not much really to focus on in that one. Anything you wanted to say before we keep moving?
No, they just did enough. And that's the difference between the good sides this year. They're doing enough even when they're off the game.
Yep.
And yeah, the Canes are a scary prospect at home come finals.
Really, really scary. Now let's move across to Melbourne, which was the second game of Friday night. This was doubleheader with the Wallaroos and USA test match that got played earlier in the afternoon. Melbourne Rebels hosted the Hamilton Chiefs or Waikato Chiefs. 23-26 to the Chiefs was the final score here. But before we actually talk about the rugby for a minute, let's just talk about some of the off-field things that were happening. This potentially could be the Melbourne Rebels' last ever home game in Super Rugby Pacific ever. But we don't know. Like, we're two rounds out from the end of the competition and we don't know whether the Rebels are folding or moving forward. Fans are turning up to the last game in Melbourne, not knowing if this is the last time they see this team play. Whole process has been handled so badly. And it's just so confusing for everyone involved.
It was really emotional, I found, seeing the crowd come in and stand at the 14th minute to celebrate 14 years of the Rebels. I found that really, really powerful. Just as an Australian rugby fan, you know, we've seen it in the past, teams going down and how that affects clubs. And it was great to see a big crowd there to celebrate, or at least commemorate is probably the right word. But I found it interesting in the sense that was the biggest crowd by far. I would have loved to see a bigger crowd earlier in the year, Mitch. Yep. Like it seems trite to say it now, you know, what is potentially the end of an era, but they've had some shocking crowds through the year. And I would have loved to see that from the start, you know, during Super Round, like in other derby games. I mean, it's almost unfair to see a crowd that size if what they're trying to commemorate is potentially the end of something bigger down there. So, I mean, we don't know. We don't have the details. And I'm the first to put my hand up and say I was pretty tough on the Rebels when they played the Blues, speaking at their, you know, lack of belief and fading away. There was none of that against the Chiefs. They grounded out to the very end. When Lockie Anderson goes over with 5 minutes to go, and the conversion goes over to tie things up, I thought we're on for the upset of the season here. No one would have picked it at the start. And of course, it's Damien McKenzie who has the last laugh with the penalty. Like, it's not fair. It's another one of those scripts that seems to write itself. But yeah, real guts from the Rebels. It was, I found that quite emotional watching that game. How about you?
Yeah, it's very bittersweet watching the Rebels play in Super Rugby this season. Take away the offside, off-field things that are going on, the story and the narrative that's being played out in the media. So much water to go under that bridge, yet we don't know if they will fold. It looks very much like it's going to happen, but who knows? Twiggy Forrest might have a twin that lives in Melbourne that's going to come out at the 11th hour and save things. But the results on the field have been so good this season, and the Rebels are currently sitting in sixth place on the table. With two weeks to go, they've nearly all but locked in a finals berth for the first time ever in a combined Super Rugby tournament. And to think that a team that has come into Super Rugby Pacific week two, I think the news broke that the liquidation and the mismanagement of funds and everything that was going on, and the tax and all of the stuff that's happened off the field, that news broke, and you could forgive the club for just folding under that pressure, for the players to just go, this is too much. I can't play. I can't put in a performance week in, week out. But to their credit, they haven't done that. And their last game against the Chiefs, who very well through this tournament have been tournament favourites, them, Hurricanes and the Blues at the moment are looking like the teams to beat, and they push them right to the last minute. And they're playing some really exciting footy all through their season. So it has been a shame as an Australian rugby fan to see that fans aren't showing up and supporting them throughout the season. But the fact that there was a crowd there, the fact that the crowd stood up and celebrated at the 14th minute with that standing ovation was good to see. And there's so much fight left in this team, even with the likes of Taniel Tupou that's not playing through injury. They're still showing up and pushing it to the top Kiwi teams, which was awesome.
Yeah, quick shout out to Nick Euster as well. He's come out of nowhere this year in that sort of centres role. We've seen him used as a fullback in covering 22, 23 in the past. But the past fortnight, he's made a big name for himself on the highlights reel. He's banging over 50-plus metre penalties. He ironed out Josh Fluke a couple of times against the Reds last week, got himself on the reel. He's a bigger-bodied centre, and it's good to see him finally come into his own. I know he's been playing QPR for a few years. He's sort of done his tracks, and it's great to see someone who's been a bit of a journeyman step up and deliver on the Super Rugby stage. It's always nice to see those storylines.
And he can kick goals. Where did that come from?
Yeah.
Why are we persisting? Why are they persisting with Carter Gordon, who's missing them from in front, if there's a backup who can kick goals? I was really worried when Carter went off that HIA and then ultimately didn't come back from it. But I was like, okay, so if we score or get a penalty, the Rebels, who's going to kick it? Because if Carter's the only one that's taking shots at goal this season with his track record, it would make you think there's no one else available. Up stands Euster and he's kicking them from everywhere. It's like, geez, maybe he should have been kicking them a few weeks back and they might have iced a few of the other tighter games earlier in the season.
Yeah, it's a tough sell. But interesting result there. I'm really glad that we'll probably see Rebels in the finals and interested to see where they end up playing. But we should probably go to the big bumper Saturday, Mitch. It was a bad start for my mob in Queensland. Maybe you can get us started.
28-19 is the final score in this one. 28-19 to the Fijian Drua in Fiji. Not the result that the Queensland Reds wanted. Not the result that they needed for their season. If there's one thing that we can put this loss down to, it has to be a bloke from the NRL, the Melbourne Storm, Suliasi Vunivalu. Two yellow cards, ultimately a red card for tripping. Have you ever seen it? Ever at this level?
No. I've never seen it. It was such a hard watch. There was great positivity for the Reds heading over there. You know, they got a win in Suva to keep their top four hopes alive. There's stacks of Fijian boys in the Reds lineup. Penny Ravi, Suli Vunivalu, Seta Uru. Like, it's... and to see Suli, fool me once, shame on me, right? But come on, like two trips. If you haven't seen it, go back and watch, because they're both pretty clearly intentional. And just one of the brain snaps to end all brain snaps, red card. The Reds are without a player for 30 minutes in total as a result of that. And you can't give the Drua that kind of space in the open field, because as soon as he was off, bang, the tries started pouring in.
Yeah, it was a really uncharacteristic Queensland performance for them. We always have spoken on this podcast for the last few seasons that Fiji are probably the hardest team to beat at home in the competition. And again, their home record extends. And Queensland didn't give them the respect that they deserved at home, didn't play the style of football that was going to win them the game. Too much ill discipline, too much aimless kicking the ball away, just not treasuring their own possession and really putting the Fijians under a lot of pressure.
I think there was just a lack of respect for building pressure through threes. You know, against the Fijian Drua, there seems to be some kind of expectation from teams to come across that you have to match them and you have to play up-tempo attacking footy. And you saw the Reds suddenly playing tap moves, you know, in the 22 from a penalty that's kickable. They turned down at least four kickable threes, and that 12 points would have got them, you know, over the line at the end of the day. But there was a consistent desire to try and plug the corner, and then the line-out malfunction. So we had six, I believe, missed line-outs. No, maybe five, sorry. And it just wasn't working without Matty Fazer in the hooking role. I mean, Josh Nasser wasn't nailing them. George Blake wasn't nailing them. And then the direction off the back of the rolling maul. You know, the George Blake went out off a rolling maul. He ran into a corner that was already covered rather than going open side. So just these little set-piece wobbles that when compounded with a failure to nail your threes or even go for them in the first place, compounded with Suli's red card. I mean, yep. The Reds were their own worst enemy in this one.
And the frustrating thing for it from a Queensland fan perspective is that the Reds have looked so good early in the season and they've put such pressure and put teams under so much pressure in early in the competition that win against the Chiefs at home comes to mind. Incredible performance there. Their opening four or five games of this tournament had everyone on notice saying, geez, this Reds team under Les Kiss are the real deal. And they went to Fiji and they've thrown away their last shot at a home semi-final or a home quarterfinal in Super Rugby Pacific this year. They are now that far out of the top four. There's no possible way mathematically they can catch back up. There's 11 points between there in fifth and the team in fourth. And so we know from the history of this competition how important it is to play a home semi-final and not being able to do that because you just didn't show up against the Fijian and Drua is frustrating from a Queensland fan perspective. One thing I guess we do need to say, though, is we can't just sit here and say how bad Queensland was and that the no credit is due to the Drua. I mean, take your hats off. How good were the Drua? They put the Reds under so much pressure. Take away the silly mistakes from Suli Vunivalu for giving away those cards. The tries that they scored, their outside backs, again, are just getting better and better. Every single time Ravatamunda touches the ball, you almost expect him to score a try. Just incredible rugby to watch him play.
Hey, look, and all the flares there, but ultimately the Drua's set piece, and we mentioned the other week against the Brumbies, is getting better and better as well. They were able to put pressure on that Reds line-out. To force seven line-out errors isn't just bad throwing. It was also terrific line-out pressure from their locks and their back row. And, you know, sometimes, you know, you have to win ugly. A bit like we mentioned with the Canes and Moana. You're not your best performance. That certainly wasn't the Drua's best, but they scrambled. They scrapped really well. Armstrong Ravula kicked brilliantly in general play to pin us back constantly without having a wingman at the back and exploiting the inexperienced Kalani Thomas on a wing, filling in from a halfback role. So those game smarts continue to grow and they shouldn't surprise us anymore. I think sometimes it does when you see them revert to a set piece and kicking game, but you know, that's a testament to the likes of having Mick Byrne around and keeping all that IP in the Fijian camp. I'd be a bit concerned if I, you know, end up finishing top three in Super Rugby Pacific and you have the Drua coming to town in a quarterfinal. I wouldn't be too thrilled about that for a top three finish, but we've probably given this one enough airtime. Mitch, take me to Canberra, mate, because there was a very interesting game that played out there between the Brums and the
Saturday Cusano. Saturday afternoon, 31-24 is the final score to the Brumbies in this one. If you haven't seen the last play of this game, do yourself a favour and go and watch it. Just, I have not seen a game end with that much drama and just out-and-out craziness ever at Super Rugby. So for those that haven't seen it, Noel Alessio gets a penalty on full-time, scores locked at 24-all. it's pretty close to the sideline for him. It's not a gimme kick by any chance. He takes a shot at goal. It hits the post, bounce off, goes in goal. Justin Sangster, I think it was, for the second rower for the Crusaders.
Quentin Strange.
Yep, that's the one. Goes to, I mean, in his head, I'm sure he's trying to touch the ball, grab the ball and ground it in goal. What ends up happening is he ends up batting it over the dead ball. The TMO gets involved. They review it. They rule that he has intentionally killed the ball by knocking it over the dead ball line. There's a yellow card and a penalty try given to the Brumbies, and they win the game 31-24. I mean, what? Just what?
It's crazy. It's absolutely crazy. The sidelines, all the Brumbies and Crusaders boys pulling their hair out, watching it play out with referee Ben O'Keefe. And he's right. By the letter of the law in rugby union, you cannot intentionally hit the ball over the sideline or the dead ball line. And given that's in the end zone, it does constitute a penalty try, which seems crazy. It seems absolutely crazy way to end a game, especially with so much on the line for both teams. The Crusaders needed that to keep their season alive.
I can't fault the card for the intentionally knocking it dead, but I'm not 100% comfortable with it being a penalty try. I don't know if the Brumbies were almost certainly going to score that if he hadn't done that act. If you remember a few seasons ago when we had Israel Folau playing for the Waratahs, when he first came into Union, I think he got two yellow cards in one in his first few games because he did the same thing. His league instincts as a fullback kicked in where he's running back to gather a ball. He's under pressure, so he batted the ball straight into touch and he got a yellow card from it. It was never a talk of a penalty try ensuing as well. So I think in some regards, the Crusaders fans are probably wondering if it deserved the penalty try, but does it really change the outcome of the game? Probably not. Noah then gets a penalty from in front, kicks it, they win anyway. But this result does mean that it's the first time in 15 years that the Brumbies have beaten the Crusaders.
Oh, so good.
And they did it in style with a heritage kit, with a collar. Let's just talk about that for a moment. How good did they look?
Oh, it's so much better. Just put everyone back in a collar. We say it so much. I feel like I'm just talking to myself. We kind of are on a podcast, in fairness, Mitch. But
yeah.
it looks so much better. Bring it back. It was great to see all the premiership players from 2004 there swanning around. Jeremy Paul doing a bit in the media this week, which is always good to see the big fella go.
Joey Roth as well, getting his name facing.
Oh, how good. Plenty going around. But this was a game that, despite Tom Wright having a blinder, and we will touch on him in a bit, the Crusaders should have won this. They had more possession. They had more territory. They carried more meters. They broke the line more. They beat twice as many defenders, and they conceded half the penalties. You know, the stats tell us that the Crusaders should have won this, but the Brumbies out-crusaded the Crusader. They scored on the counter-attack. Tom Wright, huge on the counter in this game, and they scored those long-range tries that just broke Crusader hearts again and again and again. Again, it's a team not playing to their best in the Brumbies, but doing enough to get the job done.
And that deserves them a top four finish, which is where they currently sit. Hopefully they can get the win in the next 2 weeks and secure that top four playoff spot for the Brumbies. Just focusing on the Crusaders for a moment, this is just such an un-Crusader-like team under Penny this season. As you said, they had all of the advantage, all of the stats in their favour to win this game. Take away the craziness of the last kick. They should have won this, and Crusaders teams in the past would have iced this game, would have found a way to win. The fact that they didn't do that. And Sevu Ruiz summed it up perfectly in the post-match interview with Timmy Horan. Just said, like, that last play, that penalty try, that sums up our season. Like, that's just it in a nutshell at the moment. We're just not executing. We're not finishing things off. And as an Australian rugby fan, it's almost a little bit disappointing that the Rebels didn't show up a few weeks ago when they played the Crusaders in Christchurch, because had they won, it would have been a clean sweep against the Crusaders. Oh. And going into 2024, who would have thought that every Australian team bar one would beat the Crusaders, if not once, twice in some cases? Just incredible.
That would have been such a good stat. Oh, we went so close. The Tars did it twice, though, so we can still call it 5 wins. But yeah, it makes you think, Mitch, and it certainly made me think this week, is it how much of it is Rob Penny and the mass changeover of, you know, stalwart forwards like the Sam Whitelocks and having Cody Taylor out for ages and missing a player like Will Jordan? Or the, how much actually hinges on the fact that Richie Mo'unga is a generational 10 and steered them to 7 titles? I mean, do you see him at the moment carving up in Japan? He's taken, you know, Brave Lupus into the semifinals off his bat. Semifinals off his bat. Maybe he was that good. Maybe he is that good. Maybe we don't want to see him back in All Blacks jersey under Scott Robinson. It's just crazy.
Well, maybe Crusaders fans are now starting to realise that the last 15 years or more, they've just been so blessed to start off with Dan Carter, come through, then straight into Richie Mo'unga, that they haven't realised what it is to play without a 10.
Crazy.
And then Andrew Mertens before that. So they've had a very good run. And my heart does not bleed for them at all that they are starting to lose a few games.
Couldn't happen to a better team. It couldn't happen to a better team. But well done, Brumbies. It keeps them in third place for now, and it keeps them with a chance. Albert had an outside chance of catching up to the Hurricanes, who are currently in second spot, because the Blues at the moment, Mitch, they are on a tear. They're clear top of the table after smacking the Highlanders around 47 points to 13. I don't think either of us got a chance to watch too much of this Kiwi game, but it's the boys from the 09 really flexing their muscles at the moment.
And they have, and they do that this time of the season, most seasons. They look good leading into the finals. Let's see in the next few weeks if they can continue that run through and actually push a shot and fire a shot and push for a title in 2024 with the Blues, because they've had so much promise in previous seasons and they've just never delivered at the right time. So it's all good and well to beat the Highlanders by 30-odd points, but when you're up against the Hurricanes or you're up against the Chiefs in a playoff semi-final or final, let's see if they can show up then.
Massively. And all right, time to rip the Band-Aid off. Here we are, Mitch. Last game of round 13. Western Force, 27. New South Wales Waratahs, 7. Now, I was covering this game, so I'll give you a broad caveat before we get into this one. First cab off the rank, Lafferty puts Mark Nwanganiwase through a hole, scores within the first 3 minutes, and here I am thinking, oh, we could be on here. Tars fighting for their season, fighting for skipper Jack Gordon's 100th cap. Are we going to see a bit of a boil over here in the West? The answer was No. 27 unanswered points from the Force. A big win for them and keeps their top 8 hopes alive. Talk to me as a Tars fan, mate, because that is season OVER.
Yes. I think I need you to do a lot of the heavy lifting on this one because I have very little positives to talk about from this Tars performance. That try to Mark Nwanganiwase, I guess the only positive about that is that he got a try, so he's not doing a nudie run in the Mad Monday celebrations.
Yeah, I can't believe that was his first of the year. Jeez.
First try of 2024. If that doesn't sum up the Waratah season, that they're not unlocking the talents of Dylan Peach, Mark Nwanganiwase, Tristan Riley, these incredible strike weapons out wide and out the back, that's just the story of the season. They're not capitalizing on opportunities. Where do you go to from here? I mean, looking at this performance, every single scrum was a penalty to the Western Force. Oh. They got the ref offside straight away from that. Every sort of carry ended up in either a penalty to the Western Force or they knocked it on. Very, very little clean breaks. Very, very little possession in the opposition 22. It's just this level, it's not super rugby level what the Waratahs are dishing up at the moment. And there's so many excuses going around injuries and props and, you know, these guys coming in, a guy from Argentina, Pone Falmasilli's in last week, he's out this week. Like the preparation is disrupted. But they still have a handful of Wallabies. They have Jed Holloway. They have Jake Gordon. They have Ned Hannigan on the bench. They should be putting in a much better performance than they currently are. And they made the Western Force look a lot better than the Western Force actually did play, unfortunately.
Yeah, well, I mean, the brutal truth is that the Tars at the moment up front aren't Super Rugby standard because they don't have Super Rugby players there, right? There's so much, so much fresh blood. We saw Enrique Pirueta, the Argentinian bloke, come across and, you know, he's been thrust into a new environment. Of course, he's going to make a couple of mistakes. He was in the wrong place for a few general attack structures, and we saw him cough up the ball. We saw six scrum penalties against an understaffed TARS and the ignominy of having a reserve prop see yellow for a Pete scrum infringements, which led to a push.
Literally the minute he gets on the field, his first scrum and he's off again.
Like, so tough for Brad Amatuanai. Like, really, really hard luck for him to come on in that situation. But the Force did what the Force do, which is scrap, play nasty, gritty, mean footy up front, and hats off to the tight five up front. I thought Tom Horton had a brilliant game. He was chipping at his former New South Wales teammates all night. He was really influential at the breakdown. And I thought Isaac Rodder really stood up and gave a strong performance in the locking role. I got a bit scared, actually, about 3 minutes in. I think it was after the Nwanganeetawasi try. Charlie Gamble takes a run at full pelt, and Isaac Rodder just picks him up and holds him.
And throws,
and just, gosh.
Brand body slams him into the ground.
Yeah, it was crazy stuff. And that sort of physicality and the willingness to embrace front-on contact and try and hold up the smaller TARS was, you know, pivotal to a lot of their success around the ruck. They were just grafty. They ruined so much clean ball for the TARS. And it's a credit to exploiting that inexperience up front. But, geez, I think you're right. The Force were made to look a lot better than they were. We saw some nice movements from Ben Donaldson. Bailey Kunzel continues to impress me, actually, out on the wing as a bigger body who's willing to take contact, offers a kicking option. But I think this story, honestly, is more about the TARS' lack of staff rather than the Force. Although, it has to be said, the Force are now in a position to go deep. They've put themselves in a position where they can make finals.
They can. And that's, from a Waratahs perspective, that last 3 or 4 minutes and the extra time play on from the Waratahs, I was like, boys, just let them get the bonus point. Give them a try at this point. Your season's over. You're not going to get a losing bonus point. Just give up. They scored that try, and I would have been happy for them to just finish the game there. Give the Western Force the bonus point that they need to play the playoffs. If that kicks the Highlanders out, that's a win for Australian rugby. But no, we play an extra 3 or 4 minutes of overtime, botch the line out, Waratahs kick it out. At that point, it's like, you're not doing anyone a service at this point, Waratahs. Give them the try. And that's kind of what I meant when I said before that the Waratahs made the Force look a little bit better than they were. Like, a clinical team would have scored that try, would have got that penalty, that bonus point with, I mean, they were talking, on the coverage, they were talking to Nick White on the sideline with 12 or so minutes to go. And for the rest of the game, they pretty much were camped in the Waratahs 22 and just couldn't get over the line.
Yeah.
And say what you will about the Waratahs' defense, they're not the best defensive team in the competition. We're currently dead last. So the fact that the Western Force weren't able to get over the line, from a Western Force fan perspective, that was frustrating. And you would have liked to have seen them, considering that that gives them the bonus point that shoots them up into top eight. You would have liked to have seen them do that.
No, 100%. And I think it's still going to be a tough slog. The Force need results to go their way, right, if they're going to make it into a quarterfinal. And we'll go into the upcoming fixtures in a bit. But it is good to see there start to be a bit more security. And I apologize, I got Bailey Kunzel mixed up with George Pullman. Bailey Kunzel was playing 13 when he's been playing wing for the past few weeks, so that scrambled me a little bit. But we're starting to see a bit more physicality from the Force on the offensive side. I think defensively they've been quite solid, but players like Will Harris starting to bust the line and find their straps. Reed Princep has been a huge pickup for them this year, not just the fact that he's a solid eight with plenty of experience in New Zealand, but he offers so much in attack. You know, 16 tackles, no miss, makes a couple of turnovers. You know, it's having these seasoned veterans that are really helping the Force push into the back end of the year. So, I mean, tough to see that happen in Gordon's 100th game. I would have loved as an Aussie rugby fan to see him, you know, get a win in that one and, you know, keep the TARS alive. But to see the Force press on and give themselves a real shot over the next 2 weeks against the Reds and then I think the Brumbies, you know, at this point, both of those are winnable games for the Force. And it's not just the Rebels who could break their finals drought. It is the Western Force.
Exactly. That would be great. Just a great finish for Australian rugby. One last point, talking point from this game before we move on to round 14 in our previews is this was Jake Gordon's 100th Super Rugby cap. Or actually, it was his 100th game for the Waratahs. I think he played two tour games against the Fiji, Japanese side a few years back. So there's been a few players this year. I think Jed Holloway last week was one of them who got 50. But it's not 50 Super Rugby caps. It's 50 games for the Waratahs. Anyway, the news has come out this week that Jake Gordon was eyeing a contract in France, and he approached RA and said, can I get an early release for my contract in 2025? And it got knocked back. Of course, he played his best he possibly can in this game for the Waratahs. He's their captain. He always plays, puts his heart and soul into it. But looking at him in the post-match press conference and the post-match interview, he was a broken player. Not only from just a captain who's continually losing and having to do those interviews like Michael Wells a few years ago, where he's just consistently getting asked, what's gone wrong? Why are the Waratahs not winning? What are you going to do about it? What's going to change for next week? He's out of answers. He's frustrated. He doesn't want to talk about it anymore. But you could also just see, you could sense that there was this underlying frustration with the fact that he wants out. As a player, he wants to get out of this. He's getting nothing from Australian rugby at the moment. He's a captain of a losing team that has players going off contract left, right, and center, all off on higher money. I mean, how just from a personal perspective, how frustrating must this situation be for Jake Gordon that he's stuck at the Waratahs, doesn't know who's going to be coach next year, doesn't know if this team's going to get any better. Are we looking at another 2021 season in 2025? And yet he wants to try and get out and he's told no.
Oh, yeah, we're not going to pretend like we know contract negotiations and the intricacies of all that, but it's clear that there's frustration there. And it's an interesting one for Jake Gordon when you think about the pecking order of Australian halfbacks too. Like there's a Lions series coming up next year. There's a Home World Cup in the next few years. And Jake Gordon probably at the autumn side of his career at this point as a halfback and maybe not the top of a Joe Schmidt list with Tate McDermott, Nick White, Isaac Fiennes-Aliawasa, Ryan Lonergan, you know, all putting their hands up at the moment. So it is a competitive market as a halfback, and I would take off my hat to anyone who's, you know, going and finding offers and making the most out of a career that has a short lifespan. Yep. So you can't begrudge someone that. Sure. But yeah, mate, it's tough to see it happen in a milestone game like that. You know, we love an underdog story. We love a positive story around milestones in Australian rugby, and it's so often we see them go the other way. So I feel for Jake Gordon, and even as a Queenslander, I'm hoping to see the Tars, you know, put in some stronger performances over the next few weeks. Just maybe not in the last round against the Reds.
Well, that moves us perfectly into round 14, which is the second last round of the regular season for Super Rugby Pacific 2024. Now let's quickly run through this, give our predictions or tips. So the first game of the weekend is kicked off on Friday night, 5:05 PM Sydney time. Chiefs hosting the Hurricanes. Top of the table clash there, or very close top four-ish of the table. Which way do you see this one going?
Yeah, four plays two. It's an interesting one. Chiefs at home are pretty tasty and hard to go against, but I will barrack for the Hurricanes and back them purely because I want the Chiefs to lose so the Brumbies aren't threatened in that third spot. On the flip side, though, Chiefs win, Canes go down, and Brumbies go up. So, it's a tough one. I think the Canes too good at the moment. I'm going to say Canes by three. What have you got for me?
Yeah, I'd also think with the home advantage is going to be massive for this one. So Chiefs by probably two. It's going to be a very tight game. It could go either way. We see the Hurricanes a few weeks back pipped by the Blues. So they're not invincible, beaten by the Brumbies as well. But in saying that, the Chiefs also have been beaten by some lesser teams this year. The Queensland Reds nearly got done by the Rebels as well last week. So they're also vulnerable, as anyone is. But it's going to be a cracker game. Moving on Friday night, we have the Brumbies hosting the Melbourne Rebels. 7:35 kickoff in GIO Stadium. This one, look, your heart says, your head says Brumbies in this one, but your heart would love to say the Melbourne Rebels, right?
Queensland Rebels. There's something to unpack there. No, the Brumbies at home, look, it's another one that you kind of can't tip against. I think that the Brumbies have more to gain than the Rebels at this point, purely in the top four/top two standings. Brumbies, it's vital that they get the win to stay within touching distance of potentially a home quarter and then home semi. So I think off the back of that scrap against the Crusaders, Brumbies are going to be in with this one, but I wouldn't be surprised if the Rebels snatch a bonus point here. So I'm going to say Brumbies by 6.
Yeah, that's the best outcome in this game. Brumbies win, Rebels get a losing bonus point. Both teams get points in this one and stay within the top 6 of the competition ladder. So, I mean, come on. We're talking about this centralized system in Australian rugby. Let's get that done. Let's get the points for both teams here. But yeah, I also think the Brumbies are going to be too hard at home. They know what they need to do in these last 2 weeks, and they're not going to trip up so close to the end of the season. So Brumbies in that one. Moving across on Saturday afternoon, 2:35 kickoff, is Moana Pacifica hosting the New South Wales Waratahs. We did say in our wrap-up of this weekend's game or last night's game, the Waratahs season is now well and truly over. Do you expect that they can go to Auckland and get a good result against Moana this weekend?
Not with that front row. There's too many problems up front at set piece. And I think Moana at home have shown enough through the year that Moana have been a strong side, even around set piece and at the scrum time in particular. So I just think it's too hard to lay a platform away from home without your front rowers. So I'm going to say Moana by 10.
I wonder if the Waratahs can do what you sometimes see in junior footy when you rock up on a Saturday morning or a Sunday morning and you've only got 11 players and you need 12. So you go to the opposition and say, hey, can we borrow a prop? And get Sakopi Kepu.
Can we have Sakopi back?
I mean, he's played for you guys for 2 years. He's played for us for like 10. That'd be great. Thanks. That could solve all the problems.
Just a player alone. You did it with Pono.
Yeah, exactly. But no, in all seriousness, I just think the Waratahs at the moment, that nothing's going right for them. Not only is their front row issues getting worse and worse, there was another prop injured this week, but their back line is just completely out of shape. They're not able to finish anything that they're creating. It is a winnable game for them in saying that. They do have the talent on paper to go to Auckland and beat Moana Pacifica. But look at the result last year. Michael Hooper's last game, Moana came and pants them in Sydney. So Moana know how to beat the Waratahs as well. And I think we might be up for an upset this week. So Moana is my pick there, unfortunately. Moving on, we have another Kiwi derby. Crusaders hosting the Blues. The Blues are in fine form at the moment. The Crusaders, not so much. Second last on the table. You think the Blues are going to come here and put a dominant victory against the Crusaders?
I'm actually going to tip Crusaders here.
Really?
Because despite us gassing up the Blues, and they have been very, very good, as you pointed out, they go well through the regular season, and the games that matter and the games that count, they slip away. I've got a feeling that there's going to be an ambush here with the Crusaders playing at home. You know, mathematically, they remain a finals chance, but I think this is more just a pride performance. You know, we saw the Crusaders do it against the Chiefs. They beat the Chiefs in Christchurch, and they clearly have the talent. So I've got a sneaking suspicion that this is the one that clicks, that the Blues slip up on, and the Crusaders beat him by 12.
This would be a great result for Australian rugby. And if there's a few All Blacks players in there as well that could get injured and miss a few weeks of finals,
would be
all right as well from an Australian perspective. But I don't think that this Crusaders team is going to click. I don't think we're going to see much more from them this season. And I think the Blues know what they need to do to beat the Crusaders, know what they need to do to finish this season strong. So I imagine they're going to come to Christchurch with a plan, and then they're going to just absolutely smash the Crusaders out of the park. So I'd say a 10-plus point victory to the Blues there.
Ooh, good split.
So let's move on to the second last game of the round, which is the Queensland Reds hosting the Western Force. Now, this is a bit of a slip-up game for the Reds, coming off the loss last week to the Drua. Both teams having to travel. So again, that travel element comes into play here. Do you think that the men from the West can cause an upset and beat the Queensland Reds at home?
It's an interesting prospect, this one, because the Reds now will know at the back of their mind that they can't finish with a top four, right? They can't finish and get a home quarterfinal. We saw a similar situation last year where across their final two games, they couldn't finish higher than sixth as a result of, you know, the competition ladder, and then went on to lose to the Highlanders and then the Drua in successive away games. I'm not confident that the Force can beat the Reds at Suncorp that easily, but I think this is going to be tighter than a lot of people expect. So I'm going to say a pretty ugly, scrappy game that the Reds emerge 2-point winners in.
Yeah, Yeah, I'm going to go with the Reds as well in this one. Tight game. I think the Western Force can, if they can get things clicking, they have the game plan to upset the Queensland Reds. The problem is that they just haven't clicked these last few weeks. And it's when the pressure comes, and the pressure comes on them, even if it's only for securing bonus points or trying to get the win like we saw against the Highlanders a few weeks ago, they just don't seem to execute in those crunch moments. And so I think that they'll probably push the Reds all the way, but the Reds will probably win by a few points, like you said. So last game of the round is the Highlanders hosting the Drua, Forsyth Bar Stadium, under the roof in this one. This is a Sunday game, 12:05 kickoff. That's one thing.
First one of the year.
What's that?
Is this the first Sunday game of the year?
I think we had one on Super Round.
Oh, of course.
But it's one of very, very few. Now, that's another talking point maybe for another part of the podcast. But afternoon kickoffs, Sunday games, we need to see more of them, because the crowds are tripled when they have games at this time. Just it's a no-brainer for Sansar or Super Rugby Board, whatever it is that's running things at the moment. So more of that for 2025. But focusing on this game, Highlanders, Drua, who's going to win?
Interesting game. I feel like Fiji and Highlanders play a similar up-tempo game. They like to throw the ball around. You know, you've got Big Jim coming up against someone like Ravel Tamunda, which would be an awesome matchup if that's the case. I'm seeing a high-scoring game. I'm seeing plenty of cold spates being deleted in the zoo. I'm seeing the Highlanders by 7. I'd love to see Fiji get a bonus point and cement themselves in finals. Not at an Australian team's expense, purely for entertainment, but I think the Highlanders have the wood on them in Dunedin. What do you reckon?
I think we'll see the Highlanders win this one. Just the Fiji and Drua, when they travel and away from home, they just haven't looked good this season. It's just one of those things that at home, they're a beast. At away, they're a bit of a kitten. And so we haven't seen them transition through that travel form yet. And I think the Highlanders will be upset with their performance against the Blues last week. They'll want to put in a good performance. This will be their last home game of the year as well. So they'll want to perform for their home crowd. I think Highlanders will do it by 5-ish points, I'd say. All right.
Sounding good.
That brings us to the end of the podcast for tonight. Thanks, everyone, for getting to this point. So much rugby to get through next weekend. We've got a Wallaroos game. When's that kickoff?
That's a great question. I'll quickly research and you quickly stall.
Stalling. But thank you for getting to this part of the podcast. We will be back next week to wrap up round 14 of Super Rugby Pacific. Look forward to round 15, final round. That I know for a fact the Waratahs host the Reds, so we might even get a podcast in person or something like that done for the first time in the season, which would be incredible. And then the Wallaroos finish their Pack 4 series. What times kick off? What day is it?
They kick off on Saturday, May 25th. They kick off at midday, and that's played in North Harbour Stadium in Auckland.
Fantastic.
So that means you've got four games to get through on Saturday. That'll start before the Moana v Tars game, then Crusaders Blues, then Reds Force. So big bumper weekend coming up a rugby. 7 games straight at you. Mitch, thank you very much, mate. Great to see you again after a big break.
Thank you, Lockie. Great to have you back on the pod as always. Thanks everyone for getting to this point. We will see you next week. We'll see you then. Bye.